Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a quick quiz for you here. Do you know where your local library is? Your local public library? Chances are you definitely do, because in 2019, Americans visited their public libraries 1.2 billion times. That's almost 10 times the number of people who went to a baseball game or an NBA game or a hockey game or an NFL game that same year, all combined. And in nearly three-fourths of all American states, half or more of the people who live in the library's service area have library cards, meaning despite the internet and electronic books and everything that's at the tip of your fingers with Google, public libraries are still central to community life in this country.
We have people who come and, you know, can use the computers for job interviews. We have kids who come in to take their tests for their homeschooling. And, you know, it's a place where local artists and local authors can come and talk about their works or display their art. And so it's really a community hub.
That's Kimber Glidden. She's the director of the Boundary County Library in Bonners Ferry, Idaho. But even though everyone from artists to homeschoolers use the Boundary County Library, the library has been under attack. Book challenges and backlash to a few titles on the shelves. But there have also been direct threats made to the librarians themselves.
It's amazing how many times in the last 8 months I have been threatened with scripture. It's staggering, actually, both written and in the board meetings. One lady had made a comment about anybody who shall want to harm young children will have a millstone put around their neck and they'll be cast into the sea.
Kimber told us that the threats have become so frequent and serious that the library was forced to cancel its July board meeting.
If I got shot in the course of this, I'm not going to be like, I can't believe that they shot me. I'm surprised I haven't been shot yet, to be honest.
Well, here's what we need to understand. America's public libraries aren't once again caught up in a familiar censorship battle. It's much more than that. The very existence of some libraries in this country is under threat. In Bonners Ferry, Idaho, Kimber Glidden says that the increased aggression and death threats have led the library's insurance company to deem the Boundary County Library too high a risk, too dangerous to insure. So the insurer won't renew the library's coverage. And now, Kimber says the library has to find a new insurer, and that the prices she's seeing are $30,000 to $60,000 a year more than they're currently paying. That's way beyond the library's current budget. And moreover, she hasn't even been able to find a single company who will take them on as a client.
So as of October 1st, if we don't have new insurance in place, the library will have to close.
And it's not just in Idaho. In several other states, Michigan, Mississippi, and more, some communities have gone even further and have voted to defund their libraries, their public libraries, willingly making the choice to close the doors to the place that houses everything from free Wi-Fi and community spaces to read-alouds of Goodnight Moon to the latest James Patterson thriller and the Holy Bible. Now, knowledge has always been threatening. Human history is full of societies that close and then lose their freedom by first closing the minds of the people who live in those societies. So what does it say about this country right now that threats against a library are deemed so severe that communities risk losing the place that gives them access to the world and to each other? Or that in other places, they're doing it to themselves. Well, Deborah Caldwell-Stone joins us. She's the director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom, and she's with us from Chicago. Deborah, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me on, Meghna.
We're also joined today by Patrick Sweeney. He's the political director of Every Library, the first and only national political action committee for America's public libraries. He's also a former librarian himself. Patrick, welcome to you.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me.
So libraries have always been the focus of some sort of campaign or another. I can remember from, you know, the past millennia when I was in high school and our library had a display of all the books that had attempted to have been banned. That in and of itself is not necessarily new, but there seems like there's something more going on. So Deborah, how would you describe the climate around American libraries right now?
I think that we're seeing the result of a divisive campaign intended to limit everyone's access to information, to really sanction one viewpoint, one political view, one approach to information, to prevent everyone from having the ability to make choices for themselves. We are observing organized advocacy groups try to impose an agenda on libraries to change policies, to ban books, to really limit the ability of the public library to serve as a community resource that meets the information needs of everyone in the community, but instead limits their offerings to what's approved by a few political groups in the community. Mm. And this has had very real consequences for libraries across the country. We're seeing contentious board meetings. We're seeing librarians actually charged in criminal court with pandering obscenity to minors. And we're also working with libraries, closely monitoring situations like you've described, where there's been an effort to either defund the library or take over the library board in order to impose a particular agenda.
Yeah. Well, actually, so I want to talk more about those specific cases because, you know, there aren't thousands of them yet, but they're also not infrequent. So Patrick Sweeney, can we spend a minute or two talking about what happened last month in Michigan, in Jamestown Township, where the voters of Jamestown Township actually voted, and ironically, some folks cast their ballots in the library themselves because that's their polling location, to gut the library's operating budget for 2023. Can you tell us about what happened there?
Yeah, you know, we saw a significant ramp up of heated rhetoric around some things that the public disagreed with the library having, some books on the shelves, a program or a display. Which were very minor in frequency and very minor in the overall percentage of the collection. And based on that, there was a highly targeted campaign that called librarians groomers, that called for a number of violent actions towards libraries and librarians. And it ramped up the public and got the public to vote against funding that library. I think they lost 85% of their budget, which in effect closes it.
Yeah.
What's interesting about that is the, you know, they launched a GoFundMe to bring back some of that funding, and they've raised over $260,000, including a $50,000 donation from Nora Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
So
the thing that seems quite disturbing, I'll come out and say it, is that in August, when voters cast their ballots, they chose to defund the library by a 25-point margin, 62% to 37%. Now, I'm not sure what the actual turnout was in that vote, because I've been reading subsequently in Michigan newspapers that many people are saying, well, they didn't even know the vote was happening, so they might have gone had they known and voted in favor of preserving the library. But I wanted to share with folks some of the reasons why people said that they did vote for defunding the library. This is the Patmos Library in Jamestown Township, Michigan, because just after that millage vote to defund the library board held a meeting. And lots of people spoke in favor of preserving the library, But others did stand up and say clearly why they voted to defund. And here's an example of that.
Our tax dollars should never be spent on reading material that grooms children by normalizing sex actions. Participating in sexual dialogue with a minor is illegal. It's called grooming. The content in some of the books in Patmos Library Teens contains graphic sexual dialogue and narratives. Clearly, if an adult were to read some of the books in the library to a minor, they would be legally charged.
Patrick Sweeney, respond to that. What do you hear there?
Yeah, so the books in question, it's two or three books, and the excerpts from those books are a few sentences and a couple of pictures. And when you look at what it takes to ban a book for indecency or call something indecency, it has to pass a test. And every time that these books have been looked at by a review board, where the requirement of the review board is to read the book and comment on it, they find that it does have literary merit. The books aren't just telling children that the books are not at all telling children to have sex. They're telling children what is appropriate and acceptable. You know, if they are being abused, if they are being sexualized, it tells them, you know, that it's okay to say no to that kind of abuse. It's okay to say no to those activities. And it's the books are themselves taken in their whole are very anti-grooming. They're anti-sexualizing children. But in order to have that discussion, there are discussions about sexuality within those books. And that's the part that they disagree with. I'm not sure how to have that conversation with children about, you know, if I am a parent and I'm going to have conversations with my child about what is appropriate, what is inappropriate when people touch them or when people interact with them. And some of these books and some of these materials help children grasp that.
Yeah.
And it actually leads to less molestation of children, less sexualization of children, if children are empowered and understand when and where they can say no.
Well, Patrick Sweeney, hang on here for a second. And Deborah Caldwell Stone, I'm going to want to hear more from you when we come back from the break. We're talking about the latest front in the attack on America's public libraries. More in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the latest front in the attack on America's public libraries. I'm joined today by Patrick Sweeney. He's political director of Every Library, the first and only national political action committee for America's libraries. And Deborah Caldwell Stone joins us as well. She's director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. And Deborah, we were talking about a case study here in Jamestown Township, Michigan, and the fact that voters there overwhelmingly last month voted to defund the Patmos Public Library there. And there's some very interesting things that have come out from that vote. Like, first and foremost, many people who voted, according to Bridge Michigan, one of the great local journalism outfits there, say that many people who voted to defund the library said they didn't actually believe it would close. They just wanted to send a message to the library. And that message being, of your 67,000 books that the Patmos Library has, books, videos, and other items, there were only about 90 of them that these voters had a problem with. So they were willing to risk the whole library over that tiny fraction number of titles. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that we're seeing the result of a lot of disinformation and misinformation about libraries, how librarians work, and the content of the books. For example, I absolutely reject the idea that books that deal with puberty, human reproduction, sexual health, developing good relationships have anything to do with what's called grooming. That's a falsehood that's spread by a number of advocacy groups that really have an anti-pornography, anti-LGBTQIA agenda. And these talking points are picked up. People don't have any basis to question them. And they, as a result, they are encouraged to act on that false information when they participate in elections. You know, and it's also a fundamental misunderstanding of the purpose of public libraries as a whole. These are community institutions that are intended to serve everyone in the community. And we know that we live in a rapidly diversifying society, that there are all kinds of people in every community that have different information needs. And so the library, by its nature, is going to be acquiring works that represent a variety of ideas, viewpoints, including books you might not agree with, that you might not give to your own child, but another family, another parent would want their child to read. And so there's this loss of civic engagement, community feeling, where we share a resource, and we understand that there's a book on the shelf that is there for me, but by its very nature, the library is also going to have books on the shelf that I don't agree with, but I tolerate that. Yeah. I understand that, because that means that the library is there for me as will be there for me as well to serve my information needs. And we're seeing a real loss of that community, that understanding of the library as a community institution. And the loss can be so great. A public library is essential for not only for reading books, but, you know, it's many, many times it's the community's portal to the internet, it supports homeschooling, it supports the ability to train for new jobs, to find new jobs, it supports small businesses in the community, it's a real resource. It can help seniors with applying for Social Security. The public library is really turned into that place, that third place you go to, not only to read a murder mystery, but also where you can find support and information to live your best life, to have to find work to support your family, to prepare to enter, if you're a young adult, it's the place you can go to prepare to go into college, to enter the military, start a successful career.
It's so clear, and I appreciate your description of all the functions that a library serves in a community, a public library. First and foremost, it's for the public, right? For all
Absolutely.
Members of the public, and for the enrichment of the knowledge base of the entire public in that community. And this is, in the Patmos Library in Jamestown Township, this whole movement to defund and ultimately, if things don't change, the library will close next year, has come again over a few number of titles. And there are books in the main display in that library one of the things regularly in that main display is the Bible, which, I don't know, there are sections of the Bible I've read that are, a little challenging if you're 5 years old. So the sort of interpretation of the books I want versus the books other people want, and as you're saying, this fundamental shift in the purpose, the belief in what the purpose of a library is something I want to understand more. But if I'm gonna ask you, Deborah and Patrick, to hang on here for a second, because I'd love to bring in the voice of a person whose book has been the target of many of these censorship campaigns. So George M. Johnson joins us now from Los Angeles. George is author of All Boys Aren't Blue, a young adult nonfiction memoir about George's own journey growing up as a queer Black man in America. It's the third most challenged book in the United States, and it's been targeted for removal in at least 14 states. George M. Johnson, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Mekna. Thank you for having me.
So I first want to ask you, I was going back and listening to some of the things that the Jamestown Township voters said when they decided to defund their library. And many of them kept coming back to, well, the existence of these books is a denial of parental rights. You know, it goes around when librarians put the books on the shelves or even in a slightly more prominent place, that it goes around a parent's right to determine the kind of things that a child is exposed to. I was just wondering what you think about that. Are you skirting parental rights, George?
Not that I am aware of. I think books have existed in libraries for a very long time. And so it's very interesting that these particular set of parents think that their rights trump the parents who say that their children and that their youth need the books, right? Nobody is telling these parents that they can't opt their teens or their kids out of books. But a library is a place where everybody should feel like they can grab the book that they need for their edification. And these parents who, you know, continually talk about their rights are being taken, and it's like, but when you ask them exactly which is it, like exactly which one, it's very hard for them to come up with a response at exactly which right is being taken. And even the notion of you're exposing my child or my teen to this material. And it's like, well, no, like when y'all are watching TV and a commercial just comes on, that's exposing, right? Because you don't control what commercial comes on next. And trust me, the commercials are getting a little bit spicier and spicier the older I get, you know. But in a library, Your child, your teen may never even know that my book exists. I mean, my book has been banned at libraries where it's not even on the shelf. Like, they've literally tried to ban my book at a library that the librarian had to tell them, we don't even have that book. So parental rights being trampled upon is not happening.
Who did you write the book for?
Oh, I wrote the book specifically for Black queer teenagers. And then even larger queer teenagers, and even larger than that, everybody who also has to exist in this world with us. I grew up as a teen who didn't feel seen, who didn't feel heard, who didn't have the ability to read any materials where any of the stories resonated with what I was feeling at the time. I grew up questioning a lot of things, including my own identity. And so the book is, although it's my story, it's a story, like I always say, it's a story that always has existed. I'm just the one who was allowed to tell it in this way. And it's a roadmap. It's a roadmap for queer youth who I know have those same trials and tribulations that I was having, but they shouldn't have to navigate this world in a way where they don't have resources and they don't have stories that they could connect to. And so through me, I'm giving them that story.
Well, George, you heard the description from that tape that we played a little earlier of one of the voters who said, you know, books like yours are grooming. They're grooming young children for a lifestyle that those or life choices that that particular voter didn't approve of.
Yeah,
I mean, I was going to ask you, what do you think about that charge that your book is a grooming tool? But
it's a grooming tool.
Yeah,
yeah, it's nonsensical at best, sad at worst, but you know. When I hear that term, and I'm always like, well, let me go reread what I wrote, because maybe I missed something. My book is a teaching tool. It teaches them about agency. And I also want to be very careful, because they often use the word children, and we know what they're doing when they say that. When you think child, you think five-year-old. My book on Amazon, on every website, that book says it is for 14 to 18-year-olds. 14 to 18-year-olds. This country is just backwards in terms of the way that our thinking works, because these same teens or these same quote-unquote children that they are trying to protect from books, many of them can legally carry a rifle in a lot of the states that the books are banned in, right? So it's like these same parents have no issues with their kids being able to carry and operate a deadly weapon, but feel that the book is what is going to be the most detrimental thing to their minds. When realistically, the book is not grooming. It is teaching them about sexuality, but it is teaching them about how to know what sexual abuse looks like when it's happening to them. It teaches them to understand that as teens who are going through puberty, they're going to feel these changes and they're going to have these urges and they're going to, like, those things are going to still happen whether my book existed or didn't exist. The danger, though, is when we don't teach them about what is happening to them and their bodies and their minds and their changes that are going on, they then make decisions based off of a lack of information. Mm. When we could be giving them these books and they could be making much smarter decisions, much safer decisions, you know, so that we don't live in a society that is still rampant with rape culture.
Mm-hmm. George, I have one more question for you. I've always considered writing, literature, the most powerful form of empathy creation, right? Like when I,
yes.
when I read the Bible, it helps me, it gives me a pathway towards greater empathy for people who use the Bible as their, you know, their guides in life. When I read Marilynne Robinson writing a whole series of novels about a small town in Iowa of centering the lives of aging white preachers and young wayward lost men, that is my channel to empathizing with anybody who has had similar stories and backgrounds. It really reaches you and expands not just your mind and your heart. So I wonder, that's my opinion only, but I wonder, George, what do you think as a writer that we stand to lose as a nation when we look upon those very vehicles of empathy and the institutions that protect them, libraries, as some kind of threat?
Yeah, I mean, we literally just go back to our origins when we start to deny the ability of reading and writing, and that's what it really is, right? We're trying to literally deny an ability for people to read and people to write, and that is something that my ancestors know about very well, because we were denied that ability to read and write. It was illegal for people like me to be able to read and write in the 1800s and in the 1700s in this country. And so when we are specifically targeting books by Black people, books by queer people, we're going back to this country's origins, which is interesting, right? Because that's the whole tagline, right? Make America great again. And it's like, but at what point are you speaking of? Are you speaking before Black people have civil rights? Are you speaking of during slavery? Are you speaking of when the indigenous people, like, what point was it great for the people who you're literally targeting right now? And so even like when we hear like those type of statements, we know exactly what the dog whistle is too. And so when you start to say, well, we're gonna remove these specific books and we're gonna start to remove these specific talking points, what you're really saying is that there is a second class and a third class of citizen that exists in this country. And we are going to remove the materials that make them powerful, that make other people want to know about these people and that make other people build those bridges of empathy towards these people. Because the danger is if we lose our power as the majority, oh my God, there might actually be equity and equality. And that's not what we want. We don't want equity and equality. Like, who would want that when we've been in power for so long? And so that's really the danger in removing that. It's like the onion, and we just keep peeling away layers. First it's books, then it's our rights, then what's next?
Well, George M. Johnson is author of All Boys Aren't Blue. It's the third most challenged book in the United States. Joined us from Los Angeles. George, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Deborah Caldwell-Stone and Patrick Sweeney, I appreciate your patience in listening along with me as I talked with George. Patrick, what did you make of what they said about the long-term sort of domino effect of targeting books and libraries, the institutions that you know protect these books and give us access to them?
Yeah, I mean, it's always very concerning. You know, libraries, I think, enhance a lot of our freedoms as Americans. They allow us to explore our world, make better decisions. And when we're seeing books being regulated by the government and removed from libraries by state-level legislation, that removes that ability of choice. And it's that ability of choice that gives us freedom, right? And so we are seeing an erosion of freedom for American citizens when we lose the right to access these kinds of books. And what's great about a library is, I mean, you said there's like 90 books that people are complaining about. I could go into any library right now and find 90 books I disagree with, but I'm not going to say that you can't access those books, because that would be limiting your freedom. What I would do is simply choose the book next to it or any other book in the library of the tens of thousands of books in those libraries.
Right. And so that gets me back to what Deborah was saying earlier about detecting a shift in a lot of communities about what the belief of the, you know, the core purpose of a library is supposed to be. So we're going to talk more about that and what's driving that shift in communities across the country when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the latest front in a gathering attack on America's public libraries. I'm joined today by Patrick Sweeney. He's political director of Every Library, the first and only national political action committee for public libraries, also a former librarian at the Sunnyvale Public Library in California. And Deborah Caldwell Stone joins us. She's the director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. And, you know, Deborah, we spent quite a bit of time talking about the Patmos Library in Jamestown Township, Michigan. And, you know, I want to just check myself here because we could always, you know, be accused of just cherry picking examples. But how widespread are the sort of secondary and tertiary level attacks on libraries, you know, attempts to defund or withhold funding? Are there enough of them that makes you think this is more than just, you know, select few communities?
Absolutely. We're tracking any really organized campaigns to put up candidates for library board seats that would turn control of the library over to advocacy groups whose whole agenda is censoring what's available for the community to read, taking away choice from the readers of the community. We're seeing efforts to punish libraries and librarians for having books on the shelf that reflect the diversity of their communities. We know of a library in Wyoming where they sat down and they calculated the value of the challenged books that the library kept on the shelf for the use of the young adults of the community, and they deducted that amount of money from the library's annual budget. But what we think is worse is that all this disinformation and misinformation about the books in libraries that's being spread right now is leading to attacks on librarians themselves. You've talk to Kimber Glidden in Boundary County, Idaho, where they're feeling truly under threat there. We're seeing librarians attacked on social media, held up for ridicule, defamed, really, all based on falsehoods spread by organizations that are intent on limiting our right to read and to use our public libraries the way they were intended. And we shouldn't make a mistake about this. What this is about is our fundamental right, our freedoms to think freely, read freely, to speak freely, and use the public library to achieve all of that. You know, public libraries make the promise of the First Amendment, and our liberties are very real. They allow us to grow, learn, become our best selves, provide us with the tools to participate in elections and society. And, you know, there is an effort to take that away, whether it's closing down the library itself or changing the very purpose of the library to narrow its the choices available to us, to turn it into a tool of indoctrination rather than enlightenment. And it's truly frightening to see. I work daily with librarians undergoing these threats, dealing with these challenges. And we work with our state chapters on a regular basis to address toxic legislation and regulation that are arising in the states. And all of it's based on this falsehood around what books are available to young people. We are talking about trusted adults who create collections that serve the entire community. And as you said, you know, they might be Bibles and religious tracts in one part of the library, but another part of the library will offer information on growing up, sexual health issues, like, you know, how do I grapple with, you know, drug abuse or mental health issues and things like that. And certainly we understand that that's not everyone's choices in reading, but we have to support the ability of others who need that information to get access to it, and to understand that fundamentally that we all benefit when there are public libraries in the community and when we uphold the freedom to read and choose for ourselves.
Well, you know, libraries have the very dangerous titles like the dictionary in them too. Right? now, so just give a couple more, just some specific examples. Maybe this is the one you were talking about, but I in Wyoming, I've read of in Campbell County, Wyoming, library called Gillette in Gillette, Wyoming, that commissioners decided to cut $42,000 in funding from the library because the librarians refused to remove some titles from the shelves there. There's another example of in Ridgeland, Mississippi. The mayor there earlier this year withheld more than $100,000. $100,000 from the Ridgeland Public Library because of some books he didn't like on the shelves there. Now, Deborah, you had mentioned Kimber Glidden in Bonners Ferry, Idaho, who we heard from earlier. We actually have more of her story because there's a lot more to tell. So just to remind listeners, Kimber is the director of the Boundary County Library, again, in Bonners Ferry, Idaho. And she's been working at libraries for the past 7 years, first in her home state of Alaska, then in Sandpoint, Idaho, before she landed her current role as the director of Boundary County back in December of last year. And when she became director of the library there, she said the first few months, everything was going really well until...
In February, we had one mom come in to talk to me, and she wanted to know if we had the book Gender Queer. I said, we don't have it. We most likely wouldn't get it. We're a very small, very conservative community. I said, however, if we had multiple members of our community ask for the title, we would review it and consider putting it in the collection. And that was where things started to go wrong very quickly.
So again, they didn't even have that title at the time. But after that day, that mother began going to library board meetings and began bringing a group with her. At first, it was just about 20 people, but the number grew quickly.
The group of concerned parents has grown to over 130 members. They have converged on our board meeting. The local Lordship Church and a couple of other churches have band together to have a prayer vigil to pray for the library's soul. a woman shows up and blows a shofar at the beginning and at the end of the meeting.
Kimber told us that many of the books that the group is asking to be banned are ones, as we've been discussing, about LGBTQ experiences, about race. But the interesting thing is,
there's over 400 books on that list. The Boundary County Library does not have a single one of the books on that list.
And that is something that really concerns Kimber.
This immediately tells me this is nothing to do with banning books per se. This has everything to do with controlling what information the community is allowed access to. This is about controlling whose stories get told, whose ideas get shared. So that's really the only thing that this can be about.
The threats to Kimber and her staff are terrifying, she told us. Protesters have even showed up outside her home. And she says she and her family no longer feel safe. But there's something else Kimber has to start worrying about very soon.
Last legislative session, the House passed by a huge margin House Bill 666, which would make it a criminal offense for a librarian or any library staff to disseminate harmful materials to minors. And in the midterms in Idaho, enough of the Senate seats went to the far right that there's a very good chance that House Bill 666 will be reintroduced and could pass. So in the new year, it would make it criminal misdemeanor to be a librarian. If I checked Harry Potter out to your kid and you didn't like it because of witchcraft, you could have me arrested and thrown in jail for up to 1 year and a $1,000 fine.
By the way, House Bill 666 is its actual number in the Idaho State Legislature. Now, all of these things together, the threats, the potential change in state law, led Kimber to a decision she wishes she didn't have to make. She put in her resignation last month.
And I guess I feel so monumentally naive about how far people can go into the fringe. And it's just shocking.
Kimber has told the library board chair that if the library is given adequate legal representation and is able to secure insurance or had security measures in place for staff, she would consider rescinding her resignation. But it doesn't look as if those things are very likely. And if nothing changes, her last day at the Boundary County Library is going to be on Saturday, just a few days from now. And she says 4 out of her 6 staff members also plan to leave with her that day, meaning the Boundary County Library in Idaho would have to temporarily close. So that's Kimber Glidden sharing her story. Well, Patrick Sweeney, it seems as if the similarity between the groups and the fervor around a lot of these places means, are they connected in any way, or is this just truly sort of a grassroots a conservative set of concerns that's now washing into libraries?
Yeah, you know, I would love to. I mean, it's easy to build a conspiracy theory where we believe there's all some secret, dark, nefarious, interconnected organization moving against libraries. I don't think that's it. What I think we've seen is that there's a number of organizations who have found that it becomes very easy to raise money and take action against libraries who are ultimately defenseless. It's easy to spread lies against libraries who are ultimately defenseless against their attacks. And it's easy to send out an email to everybody in your community who says, "We just saved you from pornography with children. Please donate $5 today." You know, and what we're seeing is, I don't think, a widespread conspiracy to, interconnected organizations. I think what we're seeing is a small number of bad actors being very good at raising money by beating the drum of grooming children and indoctrination.
So, sorry to interrupt you there, Patrick.
Yeah.
But so is the end game that you perceive here not necessarily just the banning of books, but something more?
I think it is fundraising and getting elected. We are seeing that the the governors who we are seeing surfacing themselves to run for president are the ones that are beating the indoctrination and grooming drums the most. We see, speaking of Idaho, Heather Scott in Idaho had like the Panhandle of Patriots come to a meeting where she was talking about the grooming and indoctrination of children, who said that they weren't scared of librarians and they defend against librarians. And, you know, librarians are average age over 40 and 80% female. So these open carry, highly militant organizations are going to shoot a 48-year-old, you know, female librarian over some books, you know. But what we're seeing is that talk was really about fundraising. It was really about riling her base. It was really about her getting the resources she need to move her personal agenda forward. You know, I think that's the most terrifying thing is how effective these lies have become in order to raise money and sow disconnect and divisiveness in our country simply for short-term political gain.
Deborah Caldwell Stone, what do you think about that? And the idea that Patrick put forward that libraries are really not able to fight back against these kinds of efforts, especially when they come through the form of defunding, because you know, they are public libraries that are whose funding isn't entirely linked to what the community wishes to, how the community wishes to support it.
Well, I agree that it's a political movement in some ways, or political activity, using libraries as a wedge issue at a, you know, during a time when we're going into elections, and that many politicians are taking advantage of this. And we're certainly seeing a number of elected officials hop on the censorship bandwagon, despite their supposed need to uphold our First Amendment rights. But I also think that we're seeing a moment where we're looking at certain organizations really wanting to dismantle public services, public education, and public libraries as a means of really limiting our access to information, our ability to deeply consider issues, to become the best communities we can be. And while I might agree that libraries are an easy target, that's because I think that we have kind of disengaged from our local institutions like this. And when individuals step up, when they become involved, when they show up at board meetings, when they know who's being elected to the local political offices, when they make their voices heard, then we see censorship fail. And I've worked on challenges and contentious issues in libraries now for 20 years. And almost to every instance when individuals show up to support the library, we see efforts to remove books fail. We see efforts to change policies fails. And you know, we, in recognizing this, we've actually created a new grassroots advocacy campaign for individuals and communities to use to stand up against these groups that are trying to not only limit access to information, but actually take over the very institution. It's called Unite Against Book Bans. And there's a website with toolkit that provides individuals with organizing tools, talking points, strategies to work with local elected officials, to participate and engage with their neighbors and community groups, how to work with local boards to preserve the freedom to read, preserve the library as an institution that serves everyone in the community, and all its, you know, all the myriad ways that libraries support their communities.
Yeah.
We have to remember that, you know, if these groups that are ostensibly dismantling the library to, you know, stop people from reading a few books are really attacking the ability of a community to have access to the resources it needs to grow and prosper as individuals and as a community as a whole.
Well, Deborah Caldwell Stone, Director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
And Patrick Sweeney, Political Director of Every Library, the first and only National Political Action Committee for America's Public Libraries. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.